This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company this morning. By most accounts, Jimmy Santiago Baca shouldn't be alive, let alone an award-winning poet. Baca, who was born in New Mexico, is of Indo-Mexican descent, and by the time he was five, he was in an orphanage, and he was a runaway at 13. He then went to Arizona State Prison for his part in a drug deal gone bad, and that could have easily been the end of the story. Baca could have been killed in prison or committed further crimes inside that would have extended his stay. And even if he did manage to avoid those fates, he could have emerged back into society a broken man. But while he was serving time, Baca discovered language, specifically poetry, and it saved his life. How a functionally illiterate man became a poet and a committed teacher is the subject of the documentary A Place to Stand, which will screen tonight at the Oriental Theater. Baca is in Milwaukee for that, but he's also here for other activities near and dear to his heart, using poetry with at-risk youth as a way to help them find their voices, and perhaps even more importantly, to get them to realize they have something important to say. Later this afternoon, he'll give a talk and reading at MATC, and he's been working with kids most of the week through Express Yourself Milwaukee. But right now, he's here in the studio with us, Jimmy Santiago Baca. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
People know your background, and you've talked very eloquently about how poetry saved your life. And I want to know what it was about words specifically that drew you out and helped you become the person that you are.
Wow, what a question. I was thinking this morning, there were several things I was thinking this morning. I was thinking this morning about Michelangelo's painting of those two hands. Yeah. And I thought, well, that's a crock, you know. I thought, why did he put those I know it was this mystical experience and stuff, but really, if you're going to paint two beautiful hands, it should be some hand reaching out of a prison cell and another hand reaching from outside of it. That's really, really the sort of painting we should have for our times, because we have those who are in prison who create their own bars, right? It's like Chomsky said, it's a manufactured consent type of thing, right? But it seems that the more that we twist and turn, the tighter the jacket gets on us, you know? And like that when you – those old movies when you see them coming to get this woman who spoke out and they put her in an asylum jacket and cart her off. Well, that's what it seems that most people are in. They're either in that culturally or a job or economically or literally. This all emotionally, spiritually. So – well, I was in prison. What words did for me was, when I went to put my hand outside the bars, I realized the bars weren't really keeping me in. So that's what words did. They activated a whole other level of existence. You know, it was just a lofting place where you perch and then fly.
Did the words give you support to do that flying?
Words, you know, it's fascinating because if you write something down and then you begin to juggle the words around, you move this arrangement of words into another arrangement of words, and you begin to move this word over here and you move this stanza up on top of this one, you have this marvelous, marvelous array of characters that begin to emerge from the page, and they begin to talk to you. And the words begin to scintillate with a warmth, and then you realize, my God, these things are alive. These are not dead. And then the more you arrange the words, the more it unveils itself and allows you to view the theatrical play of your own life. You know, and it's just extraordinary. See, the whole thing with computers, although I do use them extensively, is that it takes away that intimate exploration that every real poet has to have. You have to go into the word cave, and you have to go in there touching the sides of the cave, and you have to confront your fear, and you have to keep going back into the cave even though you know it's got all the animals, your fears, waiting for you. And when you keep on going like a child wanting your mother's apron string, and you keep on wanting to hold somebody's hand, but it won't let you, and you just have to trust the words, you know, And when you get to the back of the darkness, where it gets where it's the darkest part, it's almost like water that waters a seed in the winter and it blossoms. Logic is reversed. You know, it's a very cool experience to have that getting lost in the labyrinth of language. It's very cool to get lost in it. And computers won't let you do that. So like all other things in our age, this thing that we need in order to define ourselves as human beings, this thing called intimacy, is lacking in almost everything we do. So the commensurate with lacking intimacy, we can measure ourselves in a cell. I mean, it gets so bad now that we speak with each other through texts in our own home, you know. And if not speaking through texts, then we just go to our rooms and open up this viral world, you know, this cyberspace world. And it's interesting too, because what's happened is that the poets who take stage, young slam poets, those type of poets, they go up on stage and they do their poetry. They don't really curse. They don't try to grandstand their manhood. They don't try to be this aggressive, boom, presence on stage. It's strange because these young poets go up there and they express a type of beauty that's not available. There's not a forum for it otherwise. So they go up there and they have this really wonderful intimacy about their presentation. Look at me. I mean, I learned to read and write when I was 18. I was in a prison cell. I got stabbed. I got shot. And I have the bullets in me today. And I love the bullets, because when they x-ray me, when I go to the hospital to get checkups and they x-ray me, the x-rays come back like a constellation of stars against a background of darkness. And I love that. I'm like, my God, that's my own solar system, you know. My God, there's all these little bright white spots on the plastic, you know. And I'm like, wow. That's going to be my next book cover, I tell myself, you know. But my love of writing and my love of all of that was really tested against day-to-day sorrow and day-to-day joy and day-to-day. Somebody got a letter from their daughter, and I measured that, and I try to use language to measure the men's happiness. Or I was teaching a lot of men how to read and write, and the men would say to me, Santiago, quiero que me enseñes cómo hacer un verbo, algo así, ¿no? And I'd say, well, I can teach you grammar, but it's not just the grammar. You know, I want to teach you how to go to the visiting room, and I want to teach you how to kneel down in front of your son, and I want you to verbalize for your son what your dream is for you and him. That's literacy, when you can express the deepest emotions you have, not the verbs and the nouns, but get down on your knees and say, mira, Antonio, I'm sorry that I took drugs. I'm sorry that I was hanging out with those guys. I really am. I want to just tell you that I see you as a beautiful, beautiful leader in society, a beautiful man who has this great life ahead of him, you know? That's what I want to teach, how to express yourself, also how to voice your protest. Because what we've done is we've veiled literacy with submissiveness. So the more literate you are, the less you protest. That's toxic. It should be that the more literate you become, the greater you protest, the more you demand tolerance, the more you say, I'm not going to let my children grow up in this environment. That's literacy. But what they're teaching is if you can learn your verbs and nouns, we'll give you an A and you move on. And you get accustomed to that sort of acceptance. You keep on winning these awards by losing more and more yourself, you know.
Until, I was going to say complacency.
Yeah, complacency, yeah. Right. That's a good word for that. So you lose all of that. That's not language. That's not learning. That's not any of that, you know. Language in its truest sense, words particularly, give you, if they give you any lesson at all, it's that there's a variety of options you have in any situation. It always asks you to choose the word that best fits the poem. And what you're trying to do is just keep getting closer and closer to the emotion you're trying to express or the idea. And those are often so unique, but they're so rewarding when you actually do it. It makes you have a purpose in life. It gives you a meaning.
How did poetry change for you when you got out of prison and you were in a different environment? How did you use it then, and how did it use you?
It was like getting kicked And then five policemen beat you in the testicles for 6 days. It was terrible. You walk out of prison and you think you've been able to create for yourself this beautiful little niche in prison. I was institutionalized for 25 years. I mean, from the age of 5 to 30, I was behind bars because I didn't have no home to go to. And they had come into our village, a Chicano village. They had come in there and taken us all out. That must have been illegal. I don't know how they got away with that, but they did. You set yourself up in prison, and you teach the men how to read and write, and you have your life, and, you know.
And you were being published at that point.
Yeah. I was being published. And then you come out, and you expect the same kind of thing, but you almost feel like an astronaut that's landed on a strange planet. And it's even difficult to walk when you get out of the gates. You literally have to, like, it takes you back when you see the horizon that's so far. And you don't have to look out of a glass that they painted, and you have to scratch it to view a part of the moon. And the moon's, and you're like, whoa, you want to run back in, you know? And you want something to happen because it's such a critical time in your life. When you're walking out free, you want somebody to show up, a flute player or somebody, and sing. But there's nothing but the white prison van sputtering when this big fat guard smoking red cigarettes, you know? And Twang and Waylon Jennings, who I love, by the way. But, you know, it's like, wow, okay, there's no ceremony here. So they you go to the airport and you go home and you go visit your brother and he's high on meth and telling you, I'll be out of the bathroom in 1 minute. And you're still there 2 hours later waiting for him because you just got out of prison and you know he's doing meth and you're like, okay. And then you go to your sister's and she's afraid of you. She's scared of you because she doesn't know who you are. And you feel that sense of awkward distance between the two of you. So you leave and you walk down the street and you don't have any money and no one wants to hire you. And if you compound this into weeks and, you know, 5, 4, 5, 6 weeks and stuff, you become so, so, so deeply entrenched in your own non-existence that, you know, it's terrible. So you can return to crime. Lucky for me, I had this woman who was writing me. Who was a writer. She had two books, and she invited me to come out and live with her. She had 1,000 acres in Lower Piedmont foothills in North Carolina, so you know I had no options. I was sleeping when I came out of prison. I was sleeping on a bench at the park. Nothing. I mean, no family, no nothing. You know. So, I mean, and if you were try to if you were try to sell a poem to somebody or try to. This is what I'm good at. And the world said, but we don't put any value on that. We have no value on that. So you pretty much wasted your entire time. Yeah, but it was what kept me alive inside. Well, it'll kill you out here. In that type of situation where you get up and somebody wants to stab you or someone wants to rape you or someone, you know, whatever the case may be, you're alive. You're that close to death, it makes you appreciate life and your breathing and your hands and your feet and your face and stuff, right? And you come out here, nothing matters except how much money you have. And you just look around, and it's very easy to go back to drugs, very easy to go back to armed robbing, very easy to go back to the criminal life.
But you kept poetry.
I kept poetry because I knew that it was the only thing I could do. What we do now is we take children and we give them language, but they have no use for it. They don't want it. They don't need it. But if you take a person like me with all this life experience and you give me language, then I can express to you what that life experience meant to me, what it meant when Maria committed suicide on drugs, what it meant when my mother was murdered, what it meant when my father was found in the gutter drunk, dead. I can tell you what a beautiful morning in New Mexico feels like, you know, all these wonderful things. Language came to me at a time when I was like, oh, my God, I embraced it. I said, thank God I can express my life with this, you know, because this one guy was telling me the worst thing, Santiago, the worst thing you could ever have happen to you is to come and leave unknown. So if you don't give a person the opportunity to express himself or herself, they come to the earth unknown and they leave unknown. And that's the worst thing you can have happen to a human being, because I really do believe this place is a very beautiful place and you can have an extraordinary experiences, but you've got to have language as a way of carrying that beauty. to another person, you know?
When you come in and do these workshops here like you're doing with Lori's group, are you telling kids it's important that your experience matters, that this language will allow you to make that mark?
I tell them a lot more than that. What I do is I just came from Los Angeles where I met with about 800 kids. 200 from the ages of 15 to 18 are going to prison. So it's another atrocity. But I had the most extraordinary experience there with those kids. And my job was to tell them that you do not have to tolerate this silently. But you do not have to – I mean, physically fighting it won't work. It just puts you up as a martyr. So don't go that way. Let's be smarter than that. But let's just take language and let's see where we can go with that in confronting the system. This system has got to come down. And language is the only chisel that'll break through these bricks. It's the only one. There's no other. I said, unless you got $2 million, because there's not a rich kid in this prison. This prison is for poor people. And you're all poor, and that's why you're sitting here. So what's the thing that equalizes the playing field? Our ability to access language. And then when I start working with them on that, I got them up standing screaming poetry. I got them up standing, I love you, Mom. I got them up standing saying, I'm sorry, man, for doing this to you. I got them up saying, I got kids, man, dancing across America who they claim are criminals and who I claim just need a shot. But I got to tell you something. It doesn't work unless people like MATC and Lori's group, Express Yourself Milwaukee. Last night I went with Lori to her place, and then we had a circle and where some kids came and we talked. And I spoke about language and these two kids, even though I never met them before, you know, and even though they were much, 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 much more different than I am, I grew up in a completely different place. What language afforded both of us through the playing of music and talking to each other was an appreciation of who I was and who they were. And that's all they wanted. They just said, respect me, dude. Just respect me, man. And I was like, yeah, that goes both ways, you know. You got to respect me, too. And they're like, hey, man, it's on the table, brother. And I'm like, then it's on the table, too. And there was just nothing but smiles between us. Listen, I brought some poetry books, but I probably don't have time to read anything. But
I would love to
just announce that today is a massively huge, important day because I will be reading today at MATC at 1. And then that just turns the burners on, puts the grease in the frying pan, right? Then we go out and get us an elk, and we throw that elk hindquarters on the frying pan. That's the night. That's when the movie A Place to Stand is screened. And that's when everybody comes to the Oriental Theater and they kick it off. And I love kicking things off. It's so cool.
I can tell.
It's so cool to have everybody just loving and connected in a communal way.
And loving language.
Oh,
and I want you to leave me with a poem, if you would.
Okay. I will try to find a short one. This is from my daughter. This was called On a Plane to a New Beginning. I'm on a plane at night and the 60-year-old black man next to me. Despite suffering terrible coughing spasms, sniffles, wiping fever, sweat from his forehead with a blue handkerchief, raspy fits of coughing rack him, tells me some of his life. He's from L.A., divorced, used to box, been working the same job on the docks for 40 years. Proud he is that he and his daughter in D.C. are attending the presidential swearing-in. I smile and I go back to writing. He looks at me with bulbous eyes, clears his throat, lungs wet and wheezing, repeats he's going to D.C. to witness the greatest happening in history. Obama presidential inauguration, he repeats. What you writing, he asks, and I tell him I've been invited to read a poem at the Native American Museum for a private dinner with the Obamas. I go back to writing. I have to finish the poem. I only started when I boarded the plane in Santa Fe. Big mule eyelashes blink, huh? He clears his throat. Say what? I tell him again I'm writing a poem to read for President Obama tomorrow night. And then he rises and hollers for everyone to hear on this red eye. Everyone black except two whites. A lady to my left asks for a photograph with her, and I oblige. I smile at the irony of the situation. I'm not important. I'm not famous or rich or a media personality. So to please my fellow passengers, I rise, and for the next hour, I place my hand around the fulsome waist of dozens of middle-aged black women and take photos. There goes the poem as cameras click and time flies and we land. In the cab, I think about you, Lucia. And at the hotel, I write this poem for you, my daughter. Your ancestors, Lucia, wrote on rocks, read the dreams of mountain cliff winds, wore rainbow necklaces and bracelets made of dew. You are a descendant of those who called rain, and it listened, who spoke with sun, and it answered, who felt the emotions of wild grass unfold in green and sprout in summer warmth. Be blessed by your elders as you join the circle of life, my daughter, my sweet, sweet president.
Jimmy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Jimmy Santiago Baca is an award-winning poet, teacher, and former inmate. He's in Milwaukee this week for a series of events, starting with a free poetry reading at MATC's Cooley Auditorium this afternoon at 1. There's also a film screening tonight at the Oriental Theater in support of Express Yourself Milwaukee. There's also a free writing workshop for high school-aged youth on Friday morning at Running Rebels. Some of these events require pre-registration. There are complete details on our website at wuwm.com. As we mentioned, one of the organizations that's sponsoring Jimmy Baca's visit here is Express Yourself Milwaukee, which uses the arts to work with at-risk youth. We'll talk with one of the founders of that group when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.